The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, we're at the Sloan Conference. Jeff Van Gundy on the BS Report. We grabbed him. I pulled you out of a conversation. Or was it a conversation you even wanted to have? It seemed like actually you were happy to see me now that I'm more thinking about it. Some guy's badgering you and I pulled you away.
No. Actually, it's great here seeing so many people you competed against in a different setting, so it's good.
Yeah. And what was your last year's coach? 2006, 2007,
yeah.
And everyone, every year, somebody says, oh yeah, Jeff Van Gundy. But now it's been 5 years. You've been an announcer.
Yeah, this is my fifth.
At some point, you're just going to be announcer Jeff Van Gundy, who coached once upon a time way back when.
Could be.
Or you might coach again.
Yeah, you never know how it works out. You know, whenever, you certainly never, in a coaching standpoint, you can't replicate in announcing the competition and camaraderie
right.
that you have on a team. But in announcing, there's not nearly the frustrations that you can have in coaching. So there's a little bit
good involved. And you were one of the coaches that took every loss really, really super hard and brought it home with you. Which some coaches don't do that, but you were one of the ones that I think did to some degree, right?
Yeah, I would say I tried to get better from New York. You know, as you age, you understand the place of your job and your life a little bit better, you hope.
Yeah.
So I could do that to a point, but the nine imperfections, mistakes that you made as a coach or your team made that you think were solvable and fixable that you didn't get done in that particular time does make you stay up at night, certainly.
Yeah. So that's the part you don't miss.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it does dominate every second of every day, you know.
Yeah.
Your kids may be talking to you and you're not hearing a word you're saying. Like I always said, you know, you're thinking about how are we going to stop, Ray Allen tonight, or how are we going to What's our secondary plan for Paul Pierce, or you know, whatever it may be. Yeah, so it's always on your mind.
Do you, right when you ended coaching, the league had moved in this direction where everybody had 17 assistant coaches, and it was almost like overboard that way with specialist free agent. Just you'd see the bench, there's a rose behind the bench. It seems like that's settled down a little bit, but how many assistants did you have when you coached?
We had four. But I was just talking about this to somebody else. If I came back, it would be no more than that.
No more than four?
No. And I never believed in the specialists.
Yeah.
Because the game is a flow game that goes up, you know, back and forth. And your offense impacts your defense and impacts your rebounding. And I just really believe that you have to give your coaches the chance to coach the entire game. And so I would actually go to a smaller staff and try to make sure that we had great communication and camaraderie. And you also have to make sure you have the right people, because the more people you hire, the more chance there is for saying different things to the different
right.
players that are competing type of thoughts. And I just think with smaller staffs, you have a better chance of managing that.
It would say, my favorite, Indiana had Larry Bird as the coach, and then like he had Dick Carter as his defensive coordinator and Rick Carlisle as offensive coordinator. I think that was all they had.
Yeah, and they had Dan Burke, but he was behind the bench. They had three.
Right.
Yep.
That seems like that would be the best system. One guy concentrates on offense, one on defense, and then like a third kind of maintenance guy, and that's your staff.
Yeah, I think you certainly could make the case that you don't need any more than that.
Yeah.
That the player development coaches could easily be your assistant coaches if they're the right guys who could, you know, concentrate on whatever areas of basketball you wanted to concentrate on and still help you develop the skills and the professionalism of all the players on the team. Think about it, if you have three assistants, that's what, four each that you can concentrate on? And that seems like it's a workable thing.
I've gone back and forth with coaches, like how much coaches matter. Because like clearly last year in the finals, Rick Carlisle had a huge impact on that. On that series. I think other times you could make a case, yeah, the guy was driving the ship, but if talent is going to win in the NBA most of the time. In that finals, though, it really did feel like Carlisle swung that series to some degree of some of the chances he took. Did you feel that way when you were watching it?
I thought both coaches did a great job. I think
you went diplomatic on me.
No, not really, because I really do. I think there's much less difference in coaches than there are in players.
Yeah.
I think the three-point shot is such a huge dynamic in the NBA. So when the ball's in the air, it's very interesting how the media goes about it. If it goes in, it's great ball movement. If you miss a number of those same shots, they say they're settling.
Yeah.
And so in that series, I thought the three-point shot had a huge impact.
Yeah.
Particularly in Game 6 when they got down early. But you have to give Rick credit because, as you said, to go to Barea in the starting lineup, I thought was a huge move to try to get the right, for him, what he thought the right matchups were. But I think coaching is extremely important.
Obviously, you were a former coach.
No, but I do. I think it's extremely important, but I don't think there's as big a gap between coaches as the records of their teams may suggest at times. I think there's a huge gap in the best players in this league.
Yes.
With the right, you know, can you win it all with player X? That player, if you can, could be coached by a number of different guys in the NBA and him win championships.
Yeah.
But there's very few best players that can win championships.
So you're saying if you had one of the top four players in the league, that is a much bigger advantage than having one of the top four coaches in the league, because the difference between the fourth best coach and the 28th best coach isn't going to be the difference between number four player and number 28 player.
Number four player, and I would say number 10 player.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think it's huge when you're evaluating teams is, can that best player, could you envision him being so impactful that he brings the rest of the guys with you through the grind of a season and the playoff run and win it all. And that's why I thought the Clippers with the Chris Paul trade was so impactful. Forget just his skills. I think he's the type of personality, leadership, that he could eventually overcome all the clutter that the Clippers have had in their history.
Identity crisis.
Right, and cut through it all and be the best player on the championship team.
I agree with you because I've been going to the games and it's such a big difference watching him in person versus watching him on TV and the way he works everybody in the floor and just everything he does is so smart. How many other guys do you feel like have that kind of impact on a team? Like what would you, I mean.
I don't have a number, but if you, like I think there are,
probably. Would you say Dwight Howard has that impact on a team?
It's tough to say no because he brought him to
the
brink.
Finals.
Right? Right. And now in that year, he had more help than he has now.
Yeah.
Right? So, but I think the guys who eventually can break through see themselves as winning being important to their overall image or lasting legacy. Like you cut through like being a brand and I want to do movies and I want to do, you know, all this. That's the players that I think can, you know, win big for whatever talent level they have is the guys that it's really important to. Now they've all mastered the art of the media in that they'll tell you all I care about is winning.
They tell you what we want. We think
they know exactly what the public wants to hear.
Yep.
That money's not important and that all they care about is winning. And when you coach some of the very best, listen, you have no problem that they want to have great numbers. That pride is why they can be a great player, but it can't morph into doing what's best for the team. You know, it's the same with money. They all want to make money. There's no problem with that. But very few in the NBA are locked in on winning championships. And that means from ownerships to management to best players. It's not as important as it needs to be in many cases to actually accomplish it. And that's one of the reasons why I think the run of the San Antonio Spurs is remarkable. They may not win a championship this year or last, but they're still a championship level team because they go about it in a championship manner.
And you could easily make the case last year that they just ran into the one team they couldn't beat, and that they could have been Dallas if just the seeding had been a little different. They could have been the one that won four straight.
No question. And think about it. If Ginobili doesn't get hurt, second to last game of the year with the elbow?
They miss Memphis.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's so many, you know, one or two plays or one situation, and they got against a very hot team who, frankly, could have beaten Oklahoma City in the next round.
Your bro coaches Mr. Howard in Orlando, and I know this is a dicey topic for you, and I'm sure you've been asked about it a million times. You have your best player on the team who may or may not stay, and then he also says publicly, they got to get me more help. And you're the coach, and you're coaching the other 11 guys who have just been told, I don't know if I want to stay here. I don't really like the players I'm playing with that much. How do you handle that from that point on?
You know, frankly, it's very interesting. I never talk to him about his team.
Yeah.
So it's not something I broach or he broaches. We talk in basketball in general.
What if you were in his shoes? What if you're coaching that team?
Impossible situation.
Because he's undermined the whole fabric of a team, basically, by saying that.
Well, and you know, two things. Everybody follows your best player.
Yeah.
Right? For better or for worse. And when your best player says, I'm not in, I want out, the motivation of your team disintegrates.
Well, he was even worse. He said, I want out. Actually, no, I might want back in. I might want. It's a roller coaster.
Yeah. And then to demean publicly your teammates, it calls into question overall judgment. A lot of that stuff could have taken place behind closed doors, never made it public, and still, even if you wanted out, could have had a good year. The team could have maximized, the other teams wouldn't know that this guy wants out and maybe maximize the trade. Everybody could have come out of it a little bit better. The way he's approached it has been mind-boggling, and I think it was you who said he's putting up these MVP numbers while appearing completely disinterested or some phrasing like that.
I went to the Indiana game and he's checked out.
It's really true. There are many nights, and it just shows you what an enormous talent he is.
Right.
He can, with a very, very average team, he is able to carry them on certain nights to wins that, to me, are tremendous. But he's still not getting all he can out of himself. And that's because, listen, how much can you truly accomplish if you're not totally committed? And I don't believe, like he says, that all his teammates come up to him and say, hey, Dwight, that's business, that's okay. I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either. And I think it's had a dramatic effect on Jameer Nelson this year. Unless Jameer Nelson has something else going on, the quality of his play has slipped. And I think partly it's because I think he took this whole thing personally. He finally said that. But so let's say you're coaching that team and you get this feeling that these guys are kind of like, Dwight, you're being kind of a jerk here. Like, does that become irreparable? Is there any way to salvage that?
No. To me, absolutely, until you make a decision on what is going to happen, there's nothing you can say or do that's going to bring the elephant out of the room.
Yeah.
It's already in there. And until he's either traded, it's like Carmelo Anthony last year, or he recommits, only until one of those two things happen can you get the focus off of his situation and back onto the team and what it's trying to do. Think about it. No one knows their record. No one cares about where they're seated.
Meanwhile, they're I think the third best team right now in the East.
Yeah, you know, they're in that range.
Third or fourth,
yeah, they're in that range, but no one cares about it because
it's all Howard. It's all,
you're right. And so until you can get the focus back on the team, and you're not going to be able to accomplish, you know, or even start to bring back a team chemistry or camaraderie. I mean, that they're fractured as a group the moment he says he wants out and these guys aren't good enough until they move him on or he recommits to the team and then they can address it.
And that's something Steve Nash has just never, ever said he wanted to trade because, and I've talked to him about it, he feels like that would fracture the team. The moment he's the leader of the team, and if he says, yeah, maybe it's time for me to go, like, well, what does that say to the other 11 guys? Here's the unpopular opinion alert. This is Dave Jacoby who's here. This is one of his favorite phrases. Is Orlando, like, Ryan Anderson's playing out of his mind. Like, really, for what he does, he might be the best possible person to play with Dwight Howard. Richardson's playing better and is getting in shape. Redick's a 40% three-point shooter. Haydu hasn't been playing that bad. I don't think, you know, he's not the Haydu from 3 years ago.
Right.
But maybe it could go the other way. Maybe they add one piece. Who knows? I don't know if I'd want to play that team in a playoff series because if they got hot from three with Howard, maybe a semi-dangerous team.
Well, you think about it. Now, they were a better team then, but that's exactly what happened when they played Cleveland.
Exactly.
You know, they, listen, people always talk about, you know, you live and die with the three, but if you're the underdog, the three is a huge component to springing a surprise, particularly in a series. So they can get on a roll where they can make, you know, three, four games in a row between 12 and 15 threes, which gives you an incredible chance. Now, that doesn't mean you could do it, actually, but it gives you a shot.
In a seven-game series, there was one game the other day, I think they took 36 threes. Yeah, they might have made like 16 of them, but they killed
17 out of 42.
That's what it was.
Yeah, 17 out of 42.
They've had games where you're just like, oh, because if Anderson gets going, that team's trouble. Same for the Knicks, because I just look at that Knicks team, and I know it's becoming a popular opinion at this point, but now they go 10 deep, which in the beginning of the season they were 6 deep. They have a guy they can go to at the end of the games. They have a bench that can come in and do stuff. They have the best crowd, you know that. You don't want to go down 3-2 and go to New York in game six. If I'm Miami and I'm down 3-2, you're not winning game six. You're just not. So that's the most dangerous team in the East as a sleeper, I would say.
Yeah,
in the West, there's a bunch of teams.
And the top teams aren't as dominant as Miami is. You know, you're going to, you know, Oklahoma City is by far the best team record-wise, but I, you know, Nowitzki said it, no one scares Dallas.
Because they've been there.
Right, so I think there's a number of teams that could say, we can come up with a plan that we can be competitive against the best teams. Miami, their only weakness is defending the three. And maybe you say, at times, rebounding. But I would say it's defending the three. So you're going to have to be able to spread the floor against them because if you allow Wade and James just to roam defensively, it's going to be real hard to get up quality shots. But I like what New York's done.
I do too.
I think they've done a good job. I think they're building confidence. I think they got to get out of that 8 spot and move up to 6 or 5.
Need to get
so
to
they
six.
Can win.
Yeah.
So they can win. Try, give them a legitimate chance to win that first round series. Have that playoff feeling that they can win, and now play Miami or Chicago in the second round.
You did the game Chicago at San Antonio on Wednesday night, which I saw the fourth quarter on. And I think we both noticed the same thing, the way that team reacted to kind of doing the dagger, Dang hit a three. You could see it coming before then. Dang hits the three, game over, goes to the bench, a lot of swagger, whole bench is up. Seemed like that team was pretty locked in. That was a feeling I got because you're always looking, we were saying before we started, like the road game is, you win those games on the road, it's a different animal than just taking care of business at home. Do you feel like that team's better than last year?
I think I'm on the other side. I think it remains to be seen if they're better.
Okay.
Because Richard Hamilton hasn't played enough. Dang's banged up a little bit.
But Deng was playing better before he got hurt. I mean, I felt like he had jumped a level.
But he's going to have this injury like the whole year. So I'm interested to see. But the thing I love about Chicago, I think they're the such a together team.
Yep.
They go into San Antonio, who was 13-1 at home. You know, the only game they've lost, you know, they had won 12 out of 13, and the only game they had lost was the one they threw in Portland when they set Duncan and Parker. So this is a team on an incredible roll. Chicago's playing back-to-back on the road, hottest team in the league, and they figure out how to get it done down the stretch. Those wins are galvanizing. You go into a locker room, for those first 5 minutes that you're in the locker room, there's no better feeling than slaying the dragon on the road. And so, yeah, I think Chicago is the second best team in the NBA. The problem is they're going to have to overcome, you know, the talent of Miami.
And it's still, I still wonder, let's say they're down 3-1 in Miami in the series, and there's 4 minutes left and they're down two. Do they just go to that mode of Derrick Rose every time, Derrick Rose every time, Derrick Rose every time? Like, who is the second guy that comes in and says, I got this, let me take a play here?
Well, I think they're hoping it's Richard Hamilton, you know, off baseline screens.
I think that's a pipe dream.
Well, see, and people, when you say the name, they want to always harken
back. They think it's 2004
right.
Richard
They always want to harken not. Back to when
gone.
The guy's in his prime.
Right.
And so they always, instead of saying, what game does he have at this point in his career, they harken back to what the name is. So if it's not him, it's not Boozer in the post, I don't believe.
Not at this point in his
career. Deng is a guy who is an all-star because of how he plays.
He's a glue guy.
Right. Noah's the same way.
Noah's hot potato.
Glue guy. So who is it going to be? And I think they have to try to think about, you know, making a two-for-one trade, you know, to try to get, you know, give up two of their good players to try to get one of those guys who can maybe push them over the top. And I've always thought that they should be, of all these teams, should be killing for Dwight Howard.
Oh, I said, and also, I wrote this before the season, Dwight Howard should be killing to go there. It should be, Dwight Howard should be looking at this and going, oh, cool, I could put Derrick Rose in the second biggest city in America and win titles with Derrick Rose. That should be fun.
Yeah, I don't know why he wouldn't, but
you seem to have the same disgust that I have for these players talking about their quote-unquote brands.
Yeah, not my favorite thing.
I hate it. How about this? Your brand should be winning basketball.
Right.
How about that idea?
I actually coached a guy who had the biggest brand to me since Jordan and Yao Ming.
Yeah.
And never once did he ever utter the phrase brand. He did his commercials. He was great. But his focus was always, how can I get better? How can I help us win? And what do I need to help my teammates play well? And the thing I loved about Yao was he was always as truly as happy for other players' success as his own.
Yeah.
And that makes you remarkable in today's star athletes. And that's why you'll never hear one guy ever say anything remotely bad about Yao Ming. Yao Ming could have been the best player on the best team.
Yeah.
He could have been. Unfortunately, injuries and some, you know, teams with holes that he had to play on never gave him that opportunity.
And the summer is playing for China, I think that killed him.
You know, so it just, there's a lot of factors, but the brand thing, first of all, some of these guys, like, I never heard Jordan say it, but he was the biggest brand, but you always knew where his focus was.
Right.
But some of these guys who think they want to be movie stars, like, first of all, I've seen them. They're not like me.
Yeah.
If I tried something like that, not talented in that area. That it takes a lot of talent.
You
want to
be a singer? I'm pretty sure you're not going to have a best-selling album.
Right. And one of the things that opens up all these doors to try these different things is because you're a big-time athlete. So never lose sight of what's driving the engine here. It's your ability as a player. And, you know, sometimes I think there's so much distraction to try to be something other than who you are.
Here's a newsflash. Kevin Durant is a pretty good brand. He's playing in Oklahoma City and doesn't do any of this crap. And I would argue that he has one of the best brands in basketball. He doesn't talk about it.
Well, and
that team wins, and he's in the smallest city in the league.
Well, and even go to Derrick Rose. He doesn't ever worry about. He just signed a $250 million contract with Adidas because I think people relate to the humbleness of a Durant, the humbleness of Derrick Rose. You don't have to be these outsized personalities. You can be a brand by just staying true to yourself. And the best thing I saw from the All-Star game was when everybody else in the Eastern Conference starting lineup was up there doing their dance, Derrick Rose is standing there looking at them like, have you lost your mind? And he stayed true to himself.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with what the other guys did if that's what you feel like you need to do. But Rose was not going to be pushed, prodded into being anything other than he is. And I thought it was a remarkable little scene about, you know, what this guy stands for.
The last thing I want to talk about this conference. You and Daryl, you worked for Daryl, and then did Daryl fire you? Or like, was it a firing?
Yeah.
It was, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Daryl actually became the head guy there after we lost to Utah in the first round.
Right.
So he had been there for a year as an assistant GM, but it was already preordained.
And then he fired you.
So I was on the left field line of Rice, Texas State baseball.
Yeah.
When I get the call in the drizzle of the seventh inning that your services are no longer needed.
By this dork Elvis, the stat nerd, has decided you were not stat friendly enough to coach his
robotic stat team. No, actually, I was very stat friendly.
You were.
I am.
So why didn't you get along with young Daryl?
No, I do.
I know, you're buddies now.
No, we were then too. But you know what? I think he made whatever the organization decided to do, but I always appreciated his ability to realize that stats were important, but not the only thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's where sometimes some of these analytic people feel like the human element is not even necessary because they've got an answer with every stat.
And that's when you get into trouble.
And that's when, I think sometimes they're more egotistical than even the most egotistical player.
Right.
You know, because they think they have every answer until they actually have to put
it
into practice.
Part of the ammunition that you're putting a bigger piece
and
together.
I thought Daryl always understood that.
He does.
And he was great to work for. I wonder if she wouldn't have cut it off at 32 days firing me and, you know, at least he could have let it be to the end of the game. I couldn't even enjoy the last couple innings of my Rice game.
I probably didn't know. But what was funny is we were talking last night and he was really happy with how it worked out with Mikhail, and he was like, you know, we're looking at coaches and it was Mikhail and Jeff, and I was like, Jeff? And he's like, yeah, we would have had Jeff back in a heartbeat. And I was like, you fired him. What are you talking about? He's like, nah, we would have been great. He's changed. I've changed. It would have been perfect. But Jeff doesn't want to coach. And I was like, that would have been the greatest reunion of all time.
Yeah, you never say never.
Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton or Jeff Van Gundy and Daryl Morey? I don't know. One of those
two. He would actually be easy to work for.
Yeah.
But I think Rick Adelman did an incredible job there. And frankly, I thought they made a huge mistake when they let him go.
But Mikhail's done great.
But Mikhail's done a great job. And if you analyze, even back to when Kevin took over on those interim bases in Minnesota, I thought he did a really good job coaching. So, and he's such a great
guy.
You're
preaching the choir. I went to one of those games, and that whole Timberwolves team was on the same page. They played the Clips. It was right before they kind of pushed him out. The whole team was playing hard. They were standing up during timeouts. And
right.
You could tell they were on locked in.
Now, he may have made some mistakes as a GM, but I don't know.
I think they just want to get rid of him.
Right, and after X amount of period of time, people just want change. And but I'm really happy for him because he's a heck of a nice guy, and he's done a really good job as a coach.
And for Adelman, what a great team for him to go to. I mean, he's unleashed three guys, Pekovic, Rubio, Kevin Love, those guys are all just thriving out of their minds on that team.
Yeah. Rick Adelman's one of the guys that everybody wants to continue to overlook.
Yep.
And one day, he will be sitting rightfully in Springfield. He's that good.
And you think about, I'm sure you think about these one or two or three plays that end up defining your coaching career one way or the other. And Peja hits 1-3 in the corner. they win the title. They kill, I think, New Jersey.
Or they don't get...
Doug Christie doesn't airball that, or Weber doesn't get hurt.
Or they don't get screwed in the fourth quarter.
Or they don't get screwed in the fourth quarter in game six.
Can I say that
you
on your podcast?
You had to mention the refs.
Can I say that on a podcast?
You can say that on the podcast.
Yes.
It's been said on this podcast.
No, but no, can I didn't know I could. But I, you know what?
Screwed,
there
yes.
were there were so many, you know, one call, there was that game probably with no ill intent, but was not called correctly in the fourth quarter.
And for the record, a couple years before, you benefited from the single worst call of that whole era.
That's not true.
It's very true.
No, Jess
it was a continuation
Kersey,
play that's, was, I think, still going.
And
the Larry Johnson
well
four-point play.
First of all,
foul, beat, shoots it.
You know what?
How can you complain about officials after that?
I never do. See, I never got technical fouls, only thrown out once by Joey Crawford.
Right.
Yeah. So I was very easy on, and still would be, on the sideline on officials. I don't like, my problem is not with officiating as much as how they're told to call the game.
Right.
I don't like the flopping around. Think about it. We have all these brilliant people and they can't, we have had no plan for how we're gonna stop people from snapping their head back and trying to trick the refs.
I watched with that game, I went to Dwight Howard. He swings the elbow because that's his move for the jump hook, and every time the guy would just fly backwards. And maybe 2 out of 10 times it actually hit the guy.
Right.
But he would just...
So when are we gonna like get something in place? So that's my, you know, like my new thing is charging calls where the offensive player is sliding by, is jumping sideways, and there's minimal contact,
right,
and a guy flops back. Why should that be a charge? I mean, it stops the whole flow of the game. If you're not gonna allow the offensive player to change directions and slide by a defender and still keep giving him the call, it drives me crazy.
But you did benefit from the worst call of that whole era, just for the record.
Listen, we would have won that series regardless. And by the way, go back to game two of that.
Yeah.
Marcus Camby takes a charge on Antonio Davis, okay, that clearly was an offensive foul. We would have won game two and been up to
him. So you're saying a delayed makeup call?
Well, no, because I'm not saying that. But we would have swept him. That's the problem.
All
but
right.
We got the bad call. So I just want you to focus your
all
attention,
right,
Pat. Go back, check out the end of game two when Antonio Davis bowls over Marcus Camby.
The only last thing, and then you got to do a panel. I watched the Real Sports thing with you and your brother. I really enjoyed it. And it made me think, like, just how random life is. Like, it's not like neither of you had a conventional coaching ascent.
No.
Like, you kind of just, it wasn't even fully explained from the piece how you had ended up on the Knicks. Like, you were both,
well,
like, super small college, and
yeah,
then boom.
Well, here's my story, random. I was a high school coach out of college at McQuaid Jesuit High School in Rochester, New York.
Right.
In Rochester, there was another I had a very good sophomore named Greg Woodard who went on to play at Villanova. But in that town, in Rochester, was another, you know, high-level Division I player. So Providence College staff of Herb Sendek and Stu Jackson come in to recruit this guy and then slip over to see me to talk early about my sophomore, Stu Jackson. So I get hired as a graduate assistant at Providence College when they have an opening.
So that's first stroke of luck there,
first
Stu Jackson.
First stroke of luck. So I get where, and I'm at, sitting across from Rick Pitino, who's going to hire this graduate assistant, and he says, Jim, it's your job. He didn't even know my name. I would have said, fine. Hey, listen, Jim, Jeff, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So I get that. We go to the Final Four, my
right,
first year.
1988?
87. Coach Pitino goes to the Knicks, takes Stu Jackson with him. I stay behind. We have a bad year. We get fired. I go to Rutgers. Coach Pitino's still at the Knicks, but leaves after his second year at the Knicks to go to Kentucky.
Stu Jackson.
Stu Jackson elevated, needs a third assistant to do scouting. Hires me, okay? So I go, Stu lasts a year and a half, he gets fired. John McLeod comes in. He leaves to go to Notre Dame. Pat Riley comes in. Pat Riley, because he'd been out a year, didn't have a ready-made staff because Randy Fund was with Dunleavy still out in L.A. So he needs people. So he keeps me.
Sees you and goes,
stay. Whatever. Yeah, stay. And Pat Riley, from that point on, Pat Riley made both my brother and my coaching careers, because I learned so much. But then he goes to Miami. They won't let me out to go with him out of my contract. So I stay. Don Nelson comes in. I work for him.
That's a disaster.
He gets fired. Actually, not a disaster. You know what
no,
Don
good
Nelson
for
read?
You.
Yeah, he gets fired. But you know what his record was?
It showed you like 25-20?
No, 34-25, and he gets fired.
Wow.
Without Charles Oakley for 2 months. It just shows you the standards in New York were totally different. So I get my chance because crazy standards in New York, and they wouldn't let me out to go to Pat Riley.
Yeah, that's like six different random breaks.
And then my brother gets to go to Miami because I didn't.
And then his career gets gone.
And then
gone.
His career gets, yeah.
So if John McLeod at some point had just said, why are we paying that Jeff Van Gundy? Let's get rid of that guy. That's it. Then what do you do? You're like a
you would see me.
Ohio
I would,
State.
I would be,
like,
no, I'd be probably, you know, either as hopefully a small college or maybe I got a chance at Drexel, you know, and maybe.
It's amazing.
No,
what a great
it is.
Story, though.
No, but it all shows you about luck. You know, so people tell me that these guys are the best coaches. No, they usually had the best good fortune to either get put in the right spot or they got to coach the best players because I've seen so many great coaches never get the opportunities. That doesn't mean they're any less great.
Right. Well, it's like this conference. Somebody here might meet somebody today and become a GM 15 years from now, and then all of a sudden they look back, and it was that one day where they met that one person, and then it got
stroke
going.
Of, yeah. Yeah. Good fortune.
Jeff Van Gundy, good luck with Breen this season.
Thank
I'm sure
you.
I will see you around.
All right.
Thank you.
Target to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.